Welcome to The Monkey Show. In a normal week, this would be your weekly way into this week's higher education news policy analysis. But this is a special edition all about how you can be a contributor to wonky.com and be part of shaping the higher education debate.
Something that was on the site this week about universities being a bit more like businesses, again, that's pretty controversial to some people, but I think that idea of what...
That was me as well, wasn't it? I'm a one-woman controversy machine. I'm your host, Monkey Editor Debbie McVitie, and joining me today to discuss the whys and wherefores of higher education commentary are two fantastic guests. In Birmingham, Adam Matthews is a Senior Research Fellow at the School of Education at the University of Birmingham and the convener of a module called Higher Education Futures, where the assessment is going to be a comment piece for Monkey, or indeed other outlets are available. So, shout out to any students listening. Adam, can you give us a quick flavour of the programme that this module is a part of? Who's it for? What's your thinking around it?
Sure, thanks Debbie. Yeah, the fuller programme is called Higher Education Policy into Practice. It's a 60-credit online programme, all distance learning, all online. And the Higher Education Futures module that I'm currently developing and I will be running with several colleagues looks at just that, the future of higher education. But what we wanted to do was do a bit more of an informal assessment where we ask people to write a blog or a features article which draws upon academic work but really brings their personal experience into it to be a bit more creative. So we've dedicated a whole week to looking at what is a blog, what is an essay, how does it differ from an academic article, but how can you draw upon some of that knowledge to communicate with a broader audience. So it's a new way of assessing potentially, but it's also a really important skill we think when people are working in higher education policy, in higher education institutions, how they can communicate with non-experts, not within their discipline, but also drawing on lots of interdisciplinary research and theory around how people can integrate with other disciplines and work with other people in an inter and transdisciplinary way. So we're hoping it'll work out well. We've set up a new assessment criteria for this. And as you say, hopefully, once those assignments have been marked, you might be seeing them on the Wonky site in the near future.
Authentic assessment in action, folks. Very exciting stuff. And in Oxford, Michael Salmon is Wonky's news editor and has eyes on everything that gets published, not just on our site, but across the whole of the higher education sector in the whole of the UK. Michael, what is the best thing about your job?
So my job, as you said, I'm a news editor for Wonky. I see a lot of the, and pay attention to a lot of the sort of policy developments and the stuff that goes in our daily briefings. But separately to that, I do also have, a task of looking at all the submissions that come in through our shared account, not just submissions, but also pitches, or questions when people get in touch with us and myself and lots of others in the team will then work with authors to get things ready for publication, which is really, really enjoyable. The variety of different stuff that comes through Wonky's virtual doors is probably the most interesting thing. If I've fallen a little behind on checking up on our inbox for a couple of days and I go in and see what pitches are in there, it's not unusual for there to be something on research security, something else on careers, something else on regulation, something else on, some fantastic learning and teaching initiative that people are doing, which is, I think, especially when I started, it was a bit hard to get my head around all these different things and know, okay, who would be the best editor to look at this? Is this something we want? Is this something we've had already recently? But increasingly, I think it's something that I really value about the job, that you get to see into all different corners of the higher education sector and the debate.
Brilliant. And what's the worst part of your job?
Oh, I don't know.
I will make you answer that right away. You can have a think about that over the Christmas period. Let's get started then. So the kind of idea here is that we are chatting about why you might contribute to the debate and how you might do that and particularly through writing for Wonky. But in a Wonky we consider ourselves to be the home of the higher education debate. It's in our strapline, and something that we all feel very strongly about at Wonky is that we want want to hear from a diversity of voices in the policy debate and then kind of at exploring kind of university practice and strategy and kind of how universities be in the world. You know, we sort of recognize there's lots of different kinds of knowledge and expertise that exist across the sector that doesn't, you know, doesn't necessarily require policy expertise or kind of professional practice expertise. You know, lots of different, you can hear lots of different voices and that's really positive. Now, we take this for granted. We think, you know, of course, obviously, that's really valuable. But if you stop to think about it, it's a sort of odd thing to do in a funny kind of way, to try and engage in what's essentially asynchronous discussion in this very kind of stylized way of kind of producing comment articles or blogs. So Adam, I mean, you've thought about this a lot because you're building this module, but also just as a practicing academic in the HE sector. You know, you're observing, you're taking part in the higher education debate, you know, you write this sort of commentary, but you also write journal articles for an academic audience. You know, what do you think is the point of people kind of sitting down to write commentary on higher education?
I think there's a few angles to it. So I think the first one, from a kind of a serious policy perspective, you know, drawing on the policy cycle, is that agenda setting. So commentary on Wonky and other similar sites can really rapidly respond to something that the way a journal article obviously can't, because there's a long lead-in time on writing the things, but also getting them published. I always think in developing this module, we've picked out interesting quotes from writers, and we've picked out a quote from Philip Graham, that was the Washington Post president, who said, "News is the first rough draft of history." And I think often with commentary and blogs and longer read essays, that's what we're dealing with here. It sets the agenda. And I think I've read lots of things on Wonky where I thought, oh, I should do some research about that, or we've used that as a resource, which has been really interesting and useful. And you know, that drumbeat as well of those Monday morning emails that come through, that we see what's on the site, and listening to the podcast can really do that in an effective way, which goes beyond the journal article. If you are an academic writing in Listart, of course you can draw upon your academic research, but it is writing for a different audience, which we'll get onto, I'm sure, later in the podcast. Another aspect, I think, is knowledge sharing. I think it's really great to read on the site something that somebody has done, whether that's an institutional innovation, a teaching and learning innovation, something in research. You can learn from that. You can sort of a window into somebody else's world to see what they're doing, which I think is really interesting to see. And then you can test those kind of things out maybe yourself. But one of the things I particularly like is when there's a provocation. So when something is particularly provocative, maybe to start the debate, which I think is really great to set a particular position, or to disrupt something that is seen as accepted, I think can be really useful to get that conversation going.
Mm. I think there's something, isn't there, about our sector, and I'm sure other sectors would say that they're quite similar, but there's an awful lot of, certainly people who work in this sector are very passionate about it. You know, you work for a university because you care about the mission of the university, right? And you care about expanding access and giving people education opportunities or kind of advancing knowledge or whatever. So I think there's that element of it, but we're also a very connected sector. You know, we want to hear what other people are thinking about and talking about, because that's how we move our kind of knowledge and understanding and practice forward. And that's where I think having a space where you can do that in a less formal way can be really quite meaningful for people.
Yeah. And
I think
getting to broader audiences. So it's, you know, those conversations can happen at conferences, but getting it down on a short form piece of writing, I think is great, and people can comment upon those and share them, and yeah, I think that works really well.
Is there a certain kind of person who is more likely? I mean, one of the things we observe is that we are always looking to encourage underrepresented voices, and by that I mean it is, and you know, and actually if you go and look at our contributors, I mean, there's, you know, hundreds of individuals from across the whole sector, and because we've been going for quite a long time, and because because we're a very broad church in terms of who can sort of submit articles to us, we're not specific about who gets to speak about higher education. It is moderately diverse, but there remains a sort of fairly consistent preponderance of white professional men. You know, often in I guess positions of some authority, either through having expertise or through having a leadership role. And that's not, you know, and I think it continues to be quite challenging to think about who is allowed to, or who considers themselves to be allowed to speak, or who kind of sees it as a priority as part of their professional practice and persona.
Yeah, and there's a conf- confidence there, I guess, to pitching an idea to you, you know, and to a big successful site like Wonky. So I think it's encouraging people to, if you have an idea, and we'll talk about pitching ideas later, when you pitch an idea, just send something in to you guys and then you can develop it a little bit, I think. When you are developing that idea, it can just spark off something, you know, something could happen, a project that you've done, just share it, because people are interested in that sort of thing. And I think as I was saying about the provocations, if you don't agree with something somebody said, have a response to it. Those are the interesting debates. You know, when you know, 20th century academic debates, there's lots of arguments that have happened in journals, which I think are really interesting, because that's what higher education is all about, plurality of views, to start that debate going. Obviously, that needs to be done in a kind of a respectful way, but throwing different ideas in, that really brings those new perspectives to the fore.
Michael, one of the aspects of what the content that we publish on the site is that a lot of it comes from organisations that are constituted to think about higher education. So I'm thinking about the representative bodies, indeed the regulators, the funding organisations. We get quite a lot of pitches and ideas from those quarters as well. And of course, these are people who are usually from people who are hired to think about effective communications. What have you observed about how organisations in the sector engage with the debate, and what impact does that then have on how the debate is shaped?
Yeah, I think, you know, as you say, we often talk about, you know, the kind of sector bodies, which I think, you know, to the uninitiated maybe sounds a bit bizarre, but yeah, but exactly, sort of mission groups, representative bodies like Guild HE, Universities UK, who, you know, we're in contact with a lot. Same with the funding bodies and the regulators, because we are at the same time as running the sort of higher education debates, we're also in our briefings covering the news, you know, so we do have close relationships with those organizations. And as you say, you know, they will have professional comms teams, or, you know, sort of policy staff who are well versed in sort of contributing to the debate. And for some, it will be even sort of part of their job, and what they're actually supposed to be doing, you know, in a year is getting things out into external sites. But that said, I still think there's quite a lot of variation. So, you know, often, you know, we'll get things in perhaps via a mission group where it's not too dissimilar from what we might get directly from a university, where they will be sort of, encouraging us to highlight or even to speak to a specific author at one of the universities or one of the organizations they work with to say, you know, this is some really interesting work. Just thought I'd bring it to your attention. You know, that can happen. But then also all these organizations and others in the sector, commentators, they're all sort of, as Adam has said already, jockeying to set the agenda. I mean, they're aware that, you know, Wonky does have a dedicated readership within places like the Department for Education, the Office for Students, or the Scottish Funding Council in MEDA. You know, there's things that will be read on our site that would not find an audience if you put it up on your own organization's blog. That would be where you speak to your own membership. So it is, you know, there's a sense of that. But there is also just, I think, and you've kind of mentioned this, it's something I think particular to the higher education sector. I mean, I sort of would say that is the only sector I really have any experience of, but, you know, where people do just enjoy the debate, want to contribute, have ideas and think, okay, I will get them out there. This does then lead to the problem that you've mentioned around, you know, some people have the time and the luxury and, you know, potentially a helpful executive assistant who can sort of help make these things happen in a way that other voices in the debate can't. But, you know, I think that said, I'm sort of quite proud overall in sort of how well Wonky's done at, you know, giving support and making space for, you know, people at all levels of the sector to join into that conversation.
I think there's something really important for me about hearing, you know, so you might have, for the sake of argument, you know, the Director for Fair Access from the OFS putting out a sort of view about what's going on with access, or perhaps commenting on access and participation plans, or narrativizing about a new kind of new direction of travel around policy. But then you might also have someone in an institution who works on access and who can talk about how that policy is landing. Or you might have a student who has themselves been a beneficiary of an access project, or indeed has a critique of how access works in practice in their experience. And for me, the kind of point is to have those different voices, because I do tend to get a bit idealistic about this. I think you just make better policy if you have those different perspectives. And of course, someone someone working in a central government department or at a national sector organization can clearly go out and speak to people up to a point and can kind of take in those views, and there are processes of consultation that enable that. But I think keeping that real-time conversation going on a site like Wonky is part of the point is that the kind of quality of policy outcome is better because it's informed by people who are experiencing it on the ground as well as by people who are theorizing it in those kind of central spaces. And I couldn't, you know, and I certainly couldn't put data in to kind of prove that that's what's going on, but that's the sort of theory of change, I think, about why it matters. You get different and diverse voices writing in a space like Wonky.
And I think that's almost like the great promise of the internet, of, you know, the 21st century, of you can have these different voices coming in, and that has worked on Wonky, and obviously social media, maybe not so much in what's going on. But going back to that idea of the internet in the early 2000s, it was the weblog. And I don't really like the term blog, to be honest. And this is almost a bit of a rant of mine. Sometimes there's this idea that it's this casual thing that you just throw out there. But as Michael and Debbie, you've both just said, there are organizations that have got big teams that can write these, which are very, very polished. But actually coming from the individual as well is equally important. So I think it's thinking about it's sort of media literacy 101. When you see who's written something, it's why have they written it? How have they come to that point? What are they trying to achieve with this? But it's also those voices that come through. So I think I'm sort of divided on this. It's great to have that individual voice, but it's also a serious piece of writing as well. So we shouldn't, I think often when I'm coming from this from an assessment perspective, people will say, we'll throw a blog in as an assessment piece, but don't actually train anybody or give anybody any support or development how to write an effective article or an effective blog. But we do that lots for academic work. So I think there's a, in terms of the form and almost the genre of a blog, I think it's interesting to consider what the purpose of that is for. And that, as we've said there, it's pretty multiple. There's lots of different perspectives that you can come at from this and why to write a blog.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, one of the things we always say is, you know, we really, really want pieces on our site to be authored by individuals or to have an individual's name attached to them. We really don't want this to be the kind of, you know, the perspective of the university or the organization, because it becomes absolutely unreadable at that point. It becomes when it's just a sort of corporate view, because inevitably organizations have to confront lots of tensions and disagreements within their own organization. And what ends up being, and this is where as well you sometimes get this with kind of heads of institution or chief executives, you get a very, very kind of anodyne and sanitized version which you know tries to please all the people. And of course nobody wants to read that. That's the kind of worst. What you want is people taking a view, taking a stance and kind of making a case. And that's quite a different proposition than the kind of, I guess, a sort of generalized corporate communication.
And the good news is AI will be really good at the first one, but the individual perspective it can't do so well. So hopefully we're future proofed.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I mean, Michael as well, I mean, just on a kind of, I guess, we've done a little bit of work on you know, what people gain, I guess, from, you know, other than the kind of warm glow of being part of the higher education conversation, what people gain from publishing on Wonky. What, you know, what do we know about what happens when people put stuff on the site?
Yeah, I mean, as you said, over the summer I kind of got in touch with a few new authors who'd contributed recently, and it was quite an interesting mix of different things. I mean, it does depend on where people are in their careers, you know, but it's a whole range of things. So, you know, for some it was more like, you know, they had a kind of idea in their head, and just, you know, through getting in touch and pitching something and kind of making that promise or commitment to write, it sort of allowed them to think more deeply and about something they wanted to, and kind of gave them an excuse to have conversations with people in their own sort of, you know, sort of communities. You know, for others it was more just about profile building, about sort of, you know, as we've already said, kind of dissemination of ongoing research, but also sort of, you know, people appreciate that, you know, if they are, you know, beginning their careers in the higher education sector, and especially if they're looking to work in sort of, you know, what we might say kind of sector roles in the different bodies and that are kind of all around the sector, then it is helpful to have sort of already built their profile a little bit. You know, for others, I think I'd have mentioned this actually right at the beginning, but I think, you know, something that we underestimate is just that people know an awful lot about the specific thing that, you know, the specific area they work in. And often people just want to say, you know, not enough people know this. Here is exactly the details of what it's like to be in my shoes right now. And, you know, I think it's valuable for me to share this. You know, for so many different areas, you know, being a sort of HE generalist just doesn't really cut it for the specifics. And, you know, there's no substitute for just having someone who, you know, works in an admissions office just to say exactly, you know, this and this and this are going on right now. This policy is affecting us like this. Or, you know, universities are increasingly doing things this way as opposed to this way for this reason. I mean, you know, okay, without me putting any detail on that, it sounds really boring. But, you know, when done well from someone who is just doing that day in, day out and really passionate about it, you know, it's just brilliant to read.
And I think there can be something quite challenging, I think, if you're in that position. One of the kind of most useful things we do sometimes is talking, when we talk to people about what they do, and we say, you realize that's actually quite interesting. And they say, oh, okay, that's just what I do every day. And sometimes I think it'd be quite hard to sort of step outside your day-to-day kind of practice and realize that there is knowledge that you hold that is different from what is the prevailing belief from people who have more of that distance. But okay, let's assume that off the back of this conversation, we've convinced everyone that it's worth writing for Wonky, and move on to some of the nitty-gritty about what we're actually looking for, what makes a great Wonky piece. And Michael, let me start with you. I mean, that process, you know, say someone sends an article, you're looking at it. What for you makes the difference between, yes, this looks like the right thing, you know, we might want to have revisions, we might have some feedback about how to structure it and so on, but yes, this is a Wonky article, and absolutely, this is not a Wonky article.
Yeah, sadly, I don't think there's a sort of, you know, X factor magic ingredient, but I think there is a sort of confluence of things, going back to, you know, what I was just saying a second ago. You know, something where you can see, okay, there's a level of insight or a new take on an issue that we haven't had before. You know, I will typically just be thinking, okay, this is something one way or another that we're going to want to feature. It could be that immediately see there's going to be lots of editing work. There'll be discussions with the author to go through, but we typically don't mind about that. If it needs, you know, further feedback, if it needs a few rounds of revisions to get to sort of where we think it really lives its best life, then that's fine. You know, I think in terms of stuff, you know, to look at the question from the other side, the times when I'll, you know, it's rare that we'll just immediately say no, you know, thanks, but no thanks. It can often be that it's a topic that we feel that, you know, that is sort of making an argument that's already been made. You know, we'll often point people to recent things we've had on that topic and encourage them to sort of continue the conversation. It can also be that it's too broad. You know, that often people will just, you know, say that. I think the classic example of this is the sort of generative AI pieces we get, but it happens in all areas. But, you know, especially with people who are a bit less familiar with the kind of, with how our articles normally look, you know, people will often want to do a sort of snapshot of, you know, everything going on right now with generative AI, which is just, you know, to do that justice, you should be probably writing a book rather than a 1,000 word blog. And, you know, and just occasionally we can see it's too narrow. I mean, we love the narrow, wonky details of stuff, but, you know, you might just sometimes get a pitch where it would be talking about, you know, I want to talk about, you know, the importance of sustainability and the UN SDGs in business education. And we'll be saying, you know, we'll probably say this doesn't sound like the audience is wide enough for, you know, for people across the sector to be interested. This is often also the case when people say, here, I want to write something about a specific thing that we're doing at my university or at my organization. You know, then we may well say to them, you know, we want something that's a little bit more, you know, that will have a wider readership and will speak to, you know, people will be able to draw lessons from it and take them elsewhere.
Yeah, there's something very important about your starting point thinking is who's reading Wonky? And if you think about that kind of mixture of people operating at the kind of sector level, you know, engaged in national policy thinking, people in institutions, often quite senior people actually as well. So there's something about kind of about leadership and the decisions that are guiding people's thinking when they're making decisions about how to organize things in their institution. And then of course there's a very kind of large group of professional staff in different areas, so widening participation, careers, student support, you know, that sort of broad category of reflective professionals who want to think about their practice, but for whom there has to be kind of relevance, I guess, beyond that particular professional group. And likewise, if you're an academic working in a subject area, it's great to talk about your subject area, but there does have to be a bit of resonance to that wider group of professionals and leaders and policymakers as well. So there are kind of, I guess, there are conversations that work really well in a particular domain. It might be a professional domain, might be a subject area, might be a particular, you know, the, sort of, as you mentioned earlier, the membership of a particular sector organization, and there are particular conversations and articles that work better for a broader group of people. But something I advise authors is to think about what they want to read. And I'm thinking about that problem. The problem of the case study is one that kind of occupies my mind a lot, because we quite often get pitches that say we are doing this really cool thing. And I think there are people who are interested in that, but it's a very, very small group of people. And an awful lot of people would probably just not, you know, they would sort of feel a bit turned off potentially if they were sort of basically reading something that's quite descriptive and that might not necessarily have relevance to their context. So we usually say, no, we don't want a case study. You've got to kind of extract the wider learning. You've got to extract sort of something that is meaningful for the larger audience. But, you know, as a reader, what do you like to read on the site? What sort of content grabs your attention?
Going back to what I was saying about the provocation, I think it's always interesting to start something with a little bit of controversy or a little bit of a pushback against something. I was trying to think of a couple of examples, and I was thinking back to, Debbie, your review of The Secret Lecturer, which I thought was a really great pushback to the actual book. So for people who haven't read the book, The Secret Lecturer, it's part of that series of professions that have an anonymous writer talking about what's going badly wrong in that particular area. Debbie did a review of that, and I think there was a review in Happy as well. And obviously lots of people were reading it. So it was a really interesting time. That the book itself was pretty provocative, but I think you pushed back against certain aspects of it. And I think there was lots of debate going around about that. So I really enjoyed that. So it was interesting to read the book, read your review, and then see what other people thought of that as well. So that was a really great example, I think, of having the conversation going. Something that was on the site this week about universities being a bit more like businesses. Again, that's pretty controversial to some people, but I think that idea of what...
That was me as well, wasn't it? I'm a one-woman controversy machine.
You are. You're a bit of a shock. He's just trying to throw in that. But I think it's good to... I mean, that's an interesting, bigger, wider context about our universities' businesses, but also down into the detail of this, the minutiae of, well, if we can make things work a little bit efficiently, it's just better for everybody, because there's lots of things that, you know, do take a lot of time and things. So I think it's really good to... It goes from the wider perspective down to that minutiae of practice as well in many times, I think. But there's also another aspect, I think, that I use the site for. And often you'll find things that are really useful as a resource. So I think when you write something, it's there in that week, of course, because it might be included in the email, there might be a focus on it, but the articles stay there for years. So you can go back now, and there's sort of are some articles over 15 years old, I think, I'd be right in saying, but they can be really useful resources. So I've been looking at major independent reviews of higher education. And if you search for that on Google, there'll be some wonky articles come up, and it's a really nice overview of some of them. So I went and then found them. Having them as a permanent resource is also really useful. So to think about that in terms of the time. So you might not want to write something particularly that is just of that time, but think about, as you were saying just then, think about the wider implications of what you were doing, but also think of it, hey, that might be a historical thing as well. So someone in 5 years might come back to that and just spot it and find it useful.
I think and we're always quite open as well. I mean, on the book review question, we didn't get The Secret Lecturer themselves writing. I reviewed that book, but and we're always quite open to doing a book review, although we struggled to find time with it. But actually, if if you are a practitioner or an academic and you're publishing a book that you think has kind of wider resonance for thinking and practice in the HE sector, and you want to draw people's attention to it, write a bit of a pricey of the arguments you're making in the book and point people towards it. We're actually, or indeed if you've written a great journal article or done a great piece of research and want to share that, we are always really open to that kind of thing, because it's part of the sort of service we provide in terms of getting good insight and knowledge out into the wider sector, perhaps into spaces where there isn't a lot of kind of time or bandwidth to engage with the broader research literature. Adam, what do you like to read that isn't wonky?
So I'm a big fan of reading sort of magazines like The Atlantic, but particularly when they've got takes on higher education. And there was a really great example a couple of weeks ago with an article called How the Ivy League Killed America. So it's a big take on meritocracy and the sort of social divide between intelligence testing and how we've become this filtered system, which links quite closely to the political divide in the US. And I'm really interested in reading examples of that, because they drew heavily on academic research. It was David Brooks Brooks, who's the author. But it's really accessible as well. So The Atlantic is a you know, a high-minded kind of magazine in the US, but very accessible to a broader audience. So the audience reading that could be anyone, you know, they might work in higher education, but they might also have, you know, kids going into higher education, or just generally read for the public interest. And that's a really long read as well. It's probably the equivalent of a journal article in many aspects. But colleagues at the university, we've sort of shared it around and we've been reading it. So I think in terms of accessibility, it's really interesting. So when I look at things like that, I'm thinking of how can you communicate academic research to a wider audience, and they do that in a really great way. And podcasts do that a lot as well. So I'm a big podcast fan, and I think the problem is that there's almost too much to read and listen to. So I always get an anxiety about that. But a good tip, I think, for that kind of content is Apple News. So I do subscribe to Apple News. And once you train the algorithm that you're interested in higher education, both in the US and the UK, you will get constant stuff around that. So it's kind of interesting then to see what other publications make of that. So that would be my tip for looking for wider news on the sector.
And now, of course, we've got things like Substack as well, where you can kind of follow individuals because you think that they're quite interesting and you're sort of interested in their voice.
I guess
you can sort of filter by topic as well.
Yeah, again, I follow far too many Substacks and then have to sort of try and come out, because you get
$4.99 a month.
Yeah, that's the problem, and you end up paying for them and getting involved. But I think it's a really interesting perspective on the broader media landscape, where there are journalists who are setting up their own Substacks and going it alone, as it were, which becomes very bloggy in terms of you get to know that individual person and their perspective. But of course, you do lose the institutional editorial style and all of that kind of thing, which, you know, podcasts like the News Agents, you know, when you listen to them on the BBC, they talk about being freer now, but we might be advocates of what the BBC do. So I think it's interesting to see how heavy editorial aspect of this works, because sites and institutions have editorial styles that they adhere to, but if you go it alone, you're sort of free of that.
Well, and I think that's something quite important about what Wonky does, which is about curation of the conversation as well. And Michael, I mean, this struck me the other day like a ton of bricks. It's sort of quite embarrassing after 5 years being the editor of Wonky that I've only sort of just realised that's a really quite essential part of what we do. But, you know, the other day I was giving this presentation about how to write for Wonky, and I was very much at pains to say this is not about clicks. We're not chasing the clicks. It's not, you know, sometimes there's stuff on the site that really does resonate with the audience, or it's just about a very contemporary issue that everyone's very interested in. Of course, we always look at, you know, about who's engaging, who's about, you know, the scale of engagement with different pieces, so that we can kind of understand that. But, you know, we're incredibly interested in some really quite niche issues as well. And certainly our kind of judgment of the quality of a piece or how well it's done or whether it's kind of worth publishing doesn't relate to how many times people have clicked on it. And of course, then someone said, well, what is your criteria for success? And I was sort of forced to confront the fact that I think a piece is good if I think a piece is good. You know, I've sort of, you know, that we have kind of set ourselves up as people who are qualified to curate the debate and to kind of make these kinds of decisions and to try and sort of, I guess, to try and do that in as inclusive a way as possible. But what is it, you know, from your perspective coming into the organization, what, you know, what is it about us that qualifies us to make that judgment?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a sort of brilliant answer to that, which is not just, you know, experience of having been editing the kind of articles that we publish for, you know, year on year. I don't think that I felt qualified to do that when I arrived, just sort of just under 3 years ago. But, you know, I do think now that I have a good sense of, you know, certainly, you know, I'm kind of confident in that I think I know what is interesting, which is based on a sort of, you know, iterative process of doing many, many blogs with external authors, seeing how they're commented on to an extent, seeing how they're clicked on. As you said, it's not something that we sort of, you know, for one thing, people might just click on stuff and think, oh, this isn't very good. So it doesn't tell you anything about it. But, you know, looking at sort of reaction and commentary on social media, speaking to the authors about the reaction that they've had, seeing how often they come back. It's just a sort of, I think, an accumulation of an instinctive sense for, you know, what people want to read and also what has not been written about yet, just because, you know, we are following everything that's getting written about higher education in the UK in one way or another. So, you know, as a result of doing that, we have a sense of, you know, what is a good addition to the conversation and what's not.
Mm. And Adam, I mean, you mentioned a few things. One being that, of course, these the pieces pieces that we publish on the site are actually, they're generally speaking quite, they've been through an editorial process. So, you know, and while we try and make it not too intensive and kind of difficult for people, it is moderately robust. We have a house style and we certainly are kind of, we want to give feedback to get a piece from what is often a rough draft of someone's ideas and knowledge into something that is readable and engaging for the audience. You've had the experience of having your articles edited, specifically by me. Is there anything that you particularly noticed about the things that I was doing that kind of give an indication of what I was trying to achieve as an editor?
You were much nicer than journal articles, I think.
any academics listening here are nervous about it. We're extremely kind. We only give feedback sandwiches.
You weren't like the infamous reviewer too, which are particularly harsh in journal articles. But I think the main thing is that it was almost a conversational style. So almost like prompting questions within the text as a conversation to develop the piece was really good. I think we both edited each other's when we did a review of general election manifestos over the decades in the selection year. And we both looked at each other. And I think both of us said at some point, is that too academic? And I think that's really interesting. And it's really, really important to think about your audience when you're writing these things. But there's a real fine balance because when academics do public engagement or impact work, that will often be the criticism or the critique and the challenge of that's too academic. I sort of say, well, I am an academic, so
there's a difference, isn't there, between the robust academic knowledge that is, that is the thing you're trying to get to, and the sort of stylized overlay which makes which engages in kind of arcane terms and long words and passive voice and all the sort of rhetorical devices that make things less engaging. And people's ability to know the difference is pretty important, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think you're probably just switching modes a little bit. So you're going after the same idea and the same things, but you're just speaking to a different audience. It's that idea of, often there's a big competition called the 3-minute thesis where people talk about their thesis in 3 minutes. It's trying to do that. So if you are talking about, and the same goes for more complex practical issues. So if you're talking about tax in higher education, or if you're talking about admissions policies, there's going to be a huge amount of detail and technical stuff going on that you do need to think about. If someone's not heavily involved in this, how do we do it? And you mentioned earlier about people don't always think that what they do is interesting, or the knowledge they have is interesting. There's also that curse of knowledge where we know too much about what we do, so we often make assumptions that everybody else does. So it's always lifting your head out of that a little bit sometimes to say, well, how is this relevant for everybody? How can I explain this? And the editorial process is really great for that, because even just on a word, challenging to say, well, will everyone get that? Could we link it to something? Do we need to use another word, or do we just need another sentence just to explain that? So don't be too scared by the editorial process. It's very supportive and it pushes you as well. So the whole idea of writing something down, but it also then pushes you to think further, to add extra stuff. So hopefully it's useful.
Yeah, I think the thing we're always looking for is it clear what this article is trying to argue, and has it got the right amount of background information to set up the argument, and has it got the right amount of evidence to make the case, and that evidence doesn't have to be kind of lots and lots of academic data, although that's always really valuable. It can making the argument from experience, but at the end of the day it's got to have an argument. It can't just be a sort of discursive maybe this maybe that sort of reading experience, because that's just not very engaging. And at the end of the day, we want people to be engaged, because that's how you achieve the impact.
Yeah, and there's a bit of freedom to that as well when you're writing. So you can say, this is what I think, this is what I think should happen. So you might not get that freedom in other forms of writing or presentation. So yeah, I'd say go for it.
Right, let's hear from Wonky's deputy editor, David Kernahan, about his reflections on what he's doing when he's writing for Wonky.
Hello, I'm David Kernahan, deputy editor at Wonky. Some while ago now, I wrote a piece on the site called What Universities Do Now is More Important Than How They Came to Be. I sort of share a little bit about the way that particular piece came to be. And it started with thinking around the way people use groups of providers to talk about particular ends of the sector, and the idea that age had become a proxy for quality. it struck me that a lot of institutions, no matter what their official age as universities, they kicked off in like the boom of local skills, local education at a post-compulsory level that kind of happened in Victorian times. I trace a lot of examples in the Northeast that all seem to emerge from quite similar places. University and college stories do tend to be interlinked a lot, so I just wanted to make the case that you couldn't necessarily look at something that's a post 92, for instance, and say it hadn't been educating students at a high level to a high quality as long as a provider that had been in the Russell Group or something similar like that. It felt like an obvious point to me, but I couldn't find anybody had made the argument before, apart from possibly Mike Radcliffe. So I decided it was time to make it again. I kicked off with the rather striking image of carcinization, the idea that nature keeps evolving things that look like crabs. And I kind of use that as a way into the reader to think, okay, we keep evolving things in the skills or innovation sector that eventually turn out after a lot of fuss to actually have been universities all along. I just thought it was an interesting way of starting that particular conversation, and hopefully you enjoyed the piece.
And finally, let's turn to the practicalities of actually getting an article on Wonky. I think there's two bits to this. One is that process of just working up that idea or that draft and kind of building that confidence and finding that inspiration and blocking out the time. And then there is the actual process of submitting content into Wonky and then what happens next. So Adam, the sort of the tricky bit really is you know, where do ideas come from? How do you make time to write? What tips would you give?
What's where ideas come from? I think personally, or any of the work that I've done with you guys has been a response to something. So I mentioned the general elections earlier. So Debbie and I wrote a series of articles on the general election this year, but also historical manifesto texts decade by decade. And that was a response to the whole idea of 2024 was the year of elections all over the world. And it came a bit quicker than we thought it was going to be. So we had to rush to do it. But again, rushing to do something is sometimes really good way of getting it down, because you've got to get on and do it. So we did a response to that. So something was happening. So there might be something that you're working on, that there's something in the popular media or something that's happening that links to it, which is a really nice way in sometimes to sort of link it to that and extrapolate that a bit further. We did a response to TEF statements when they came out. So we did a bit of an analysis of that. So there was a big release of those. So we were looking at what institutions were saying in their TEF statement, so it was a response to that. But I think developing an idea, it's having that one little thing that you've got as a sort of a kernel of an idea, and then developing that, and that comes throughout. When I'm developing this with students, there's a whole bunch of quotes from writers, but that Joan Didion quote of "I don't know what I think until I write it down." Mm. So I don't think you're taking a fully formed idea and just transferring it to the page or the screen. I think you develop it when you're writing it. So have a bit of courage to say, yes, I'll write this, but don't think, oh, I need to know what it is before I write it, because that will develop as you go. And the pitching process and the editing process is all part of that. So the ideas will develop as you go.
Yes. And something I always think is that it's often something that you're trying to fit in around other stuff. So, and this, you know, and honestly, this includes me, you know, who is paid to write for Wonky. But if you sort of think that you need to take an entire day to sit down and write your article, you know, you probably won't get very far, because you'll have sort of blank page syndrome. Whereas if you sort of take half an hour, throw down some ideas, let them percolate, come back maybe a bit later, take another half hour at it, you know, and then perhaps sort of give it. And I think for me, I can only really write intensively for about an hour and a half before I run out of steam. So I'm always very keen not to hold myself hostage to fortune in terms of trying to sort of set aside lots and lots and lots of big blocks of time. And of course, everyone will be different on that. Michael, is there anything that you do to kind of cause yourself to be able to produce stuff?
I don't know. If there is, then I should I should do it more, because I don't write particularly often for the site. I spend much more time editing others' work than thinking about myself. It tends to be, I think, especially because a big part of my job is about just, how we're managing the higher education news. If I can see that there's a gap where there's more context than is needed than we put in our daily briefing, and or that, there's a need to draw lines from things that have happened in the past to the present in order to understand what's going on, that will often give me, the shape of what I'd just like to write about. Obviously, we do, we have our kind of wonk corners, which I think are, perhaps misunderstood in the wider world, but, we kind of clearly know that they are there to sort of be, shorter sketches that can often support our news coverage, or just sort of allow for, opinionated takes on things in a way that we typically don't allow, people just to sort of write in 400, 500 words of a sort of, what they reckon about something. It's a bit of leeway we've afforded ourselves. I think it's really important to try and carve out, a good productive hour to do some writing. I completely agree that there's no sense sort of sitting down for a full day and trying to make things happen, but you do need a bit of, undistracted time where you can, avoid having the notifications pinging in, or, just that sort of sense that you have other tasks hanging over you, which are sort of perhaps more urgent.
I think the other thing I usually all tell people is sort of, chat to other people, or share your drafts with other people. We don't need to be the first people to see it, because actually, if the question is this engaging? Does it make sense? Can you understand what I'm trying to get at? Then any trusted colleague could probably give you that feedback as well as we could. Michael, just to kind of, I guess, wrap up then, on a completely practical level, just chat through what is the best way for people getting their idea to us? What happens? What does that process look like?
Yeah, I think in the sort of simplest, most straightforward, and I would say, recommended way to do it is to first have a look at our writer guidance, which you can find on wonky.com. Looking at the menus at the top, it says pitch an article. And there's some, I think I've had it mentioned to me by many people that these are some very well put together sort of tips and instructions for authors. I mean, probably written by you, Debbie, I imagine, which sort of, has, I think, a good flavor of what we're looking for. And then the thing to do after that, again, I would always recommend, is write to team@wonky.com. One question I quite often get is, do we prefer people to get in touch with a pitch or get in touch with a draft? And I would say, behind the scenes, we're probably getting about 50-50 of that, where, either people would say, I'd like to write something about this, is it interesting? Or I've gone ahead and written this, would you like to publish it? I think both are totally fine. I'd encourage you, if you're not quite sure, to always feel very free just to give us a pitch, a couple of sentences. I will often reply to those with suggestions, other things to be aware of, what about the idea particularly interests me, which I think can be helpful. But it's definitely okay just to go straight ahead and send a draft. Just be aware that, we will give you feedback on it. I think one thing people will sometimes do is they'll say, are you interested in something like, along these lines? And then they'll get a response from me or someone else in the team saying, yes, but be aware of this. Have a think about this. It'd be really nice if it could speak to this. And then they'll reply 5 minutes later going, oh, I've actually already written it. Here it is.
Might as well just send us the draft
if you have a draft, send us a draft. I think that said, I would, that isn't like a black mark against you if you do that, but I think it's a sort of natural tendency for people who are, they've written something but they're hesitant about sending it. I think just go ahead and send it if you've written it.
Yes, I mean, and the other thing, of course, is that if the answer to the question, are you interested in something that explores student success in light of geographical differentiated career outcomes or something, we'll sort of say, well, yes, but we still don't know what the article's about. If of course we're interested in that, it's a higher education topic, however we are going to need, and again, for me it really just comes down to, well, okay, what's the argument? If you can, and I think anything that you pitch, it would be really helpful to say, can I just sum up this argument in a sentence? Well, what is the title of this article? What is the title of this article? What is the argument it is making? And if you're not really sure what the answer to that question is, then it's probably a little bit go back to the drawing board, because we're starting to be interested, but we do need to have it explained to us what it is that we're expected to look at.
That's a really useful exercise for the writer as well, to have, I've got this idea buzzing around in my head, but
can I get it down to 3 or 4 sentences with an argument that will really condense it for you? And then you can start the expansive thing of writing once you've got a bit of feedback on that. I think that's a really good way of doing it. And I was going to also say, there's several modes I think you need to be in when you're writing. So you've got that pitching mode, but when you're in creative mode, you might end up with a document with loads of links, loads of ideas flying all over the place. Then you try and write the thing up. But there's a point where you've got to become an editor mode where you actually start cutting and refining it, but and leave a bit of space for that as well. So that has to, where I was saying earlier, where you develop ideas as you're writing, which is great and will happen, but you've got to be really careful that doesn't then scope out of control. You've got to bring that back. So think about what sort of phases you're at with your writing as well, I think is useful.
Yeah. And then just in terms of the actual, you know, what it feels like, I guess. So, I mean, assuming that in the scenario where we've got to the point where you've written us a beautiful draft, and we said, yeah, we'd quite like to put this in our pipeline. Here's a bit of feedback. Here's some things we'd like it to look like. One of the things I think people always need to be aware of is we're actually a very small team at Wonky, and not everyone is looking at the our editorial kind of throughput on a you know, all day every day basis. So it might, you know, so initially it might take a few days for us to come back to you in the first instance. It will certainly, you know, and it'll certainly take a bit of time if we're looking at doing kind of edits or giving feedback. So expect it to take a couple of weeks, and then from the point at which we've agreed a draft, we'll get it into our editorial pipeline, and we'll look for a time to schedule it. And if the topic is attached to something that's really current and really kind of pressing, then we'll look for a way to get that out sooner rather than later. And likewise, if the author is particularly keen for it to come out in a particular window or on a particular day, you know, we'll try and accommodate that. But we're quite careful about not publishing too much content. Actually, we do kind of limit. We're not trying to just blast everything out into the world. We do get quite a lot of feedback that we publish quite a lot, which I think is very fair. So, it can often take a few weeks or even a month for something to come out. But we're always really happy to work with authors and try and kind of, you know, achieve a publication date that can be accommodated by everyone. But we're just not able to say, well, it's got to come out tomorrow, because there's just often not that level of turnaround time, and other outlets are available if that is your expectation. We really look forward to hearing your pitches and hearing from you in the new year, and that we'll put all the links in the show notes from everything we've discussed today, and that email address that you need is team@wonky.com. So that is about it for our special edition of the Wonky Show podcast. You can get all of our podcasts on your usual podcast feed, whether that's Spotify or Apple or whatever it is you use. And we will see you in 2025. Thanks to Adam. Thanks to Michael, who also makes the show happen behind the scenes, of course. And stay wonky.